session number 30304.
Sadrena, Reel 20. Did you have any encounters with the Focke-Wulf Condor aircraft that the Germans were using at this time?
Yes, we did. We'd seen one or two, but never at close quarters. But on going to an escort of a small convoy on its way to Iceland, there were several showers about, and the cloud was not 2,000 or 3,000 feet. We were just 1,500 feet, and coming out of a shower, we could see this small convoy ahead, and a four-engined aircraft actually going over. There was a line, the ships were in lines of three lines. And this aircraft was probably between 50 and 100 feet. And it was just going, passing over between the first and the second line, a ship, and then the second and the third ship, and pulling up away. And fortunately, there were splashes in the sea between the lines, so it wasn't a very good bomb aimer or whatever they carried. So obviously he was going to flying east, so we turned on to an easterly course to chase him, and we were just about catching up. I've obviously since checked the top speeds of both the Focke-Wulf Condor and the Hudson, and there's very little difference between the two. And of course he had four engines, but it was a much larger aircraft, and we had our two racing away at full. Well, we got up to 200 knots, which is quite remarkable. We had the advantage of a shallow dive, because he was still, although he was beginning to climb, he was still at a lower level, and so the crew were sort of G-ing me up, come on, we can do better, sort of thing, you know, and everybody came round to the front. Goodness knows what would have happened if we'd had any ill luck. Although we obviously had to man the guns. The gunner came up, and the rear gunner came up, and then decided he'd better go back because he wanted to go himself. And eventually got close enough at maximum range for me to press the button, which was on the steering wheel, and we saw our tracer dipping towards the rear turret of the Focke-Wulf Condor. I didn't seem to be quite reaching it, so Darby, the gunner, said, "Let me have a go," and I just slewed off a little to the left, and he then opened up with the rear turret, which seems rather an impossible thing to do, but on the Hudson you can do it because there are cutouts to avoid shooting your own tail. We were a little closer by this time, so I said, "It's my turn again," and turned directly back, and this time the tracer seemed to be reaching him, but his tracer seemed to be reaching us, although there weren't any marks of it when we got back. But unfortunately he'd been climbing sufficiently to just be skimming the bottom of the cloud when we saw some smoke coming from the rear of the aircraft. There had been a slight pause, whether he was, the gunner was changing his magazine or whatever, I don't know, but just whilst we were still just creeping slowly up, there were wisps of cloud just appearing, sliding down the fuselage of this Condor, and eventually the cloud covered him and we lost him. So we went back to report to the SNO, and in typical naval language, he sent, "Did you do him dirty?" And so we replied with a little more RAF propriety. Unfortunately, he got away into cloud, tail between his legs, and then the usual. The SNO actually asked if we were all right, and so he said yes, and he said thanks very much, and off we went back on patrol.
Were you ever attacked at Wick by the German Air Force?
Yes. They used to send over, as indeed they had at St Neville, I suppose it was commonplace. I mean, you can find places all around the country where people will tell you that a German aircraft came and just shot apparently at random, although there were also reports of a more determined strike of something or other. The ballroom, I don't know whether they could identify it as such, in Middlesbrough, for instance, had a direct hit and during one of these daytime forays. But at Wick, we had bicycles at Wick, and we developed a pastime of cycling along the end of the dormitories where the doors were, which meant that there was a concrete path about 4 inches above ground level, extending about 6 feet out away from the door. And so this is a sort of steeplechase course where a couple of us would have a race along the having to pull the bike over, you know how he used to pull the bike up and over onto a step, this aircraft came in this particular day and sent a line of bullets along much the same track that we were following with our bicycles. Because there was a distraction, the leading cyclist came a cropper and didn't pull up over one of these obstacles, which led to a pile-up, we decided that a return visit was needed, and fortunately we were able to fly. The squadron at Wick was able to fly, whereas Stavanger was open at Norway, in Norway. We paid him a visit.
At this time as well, am I right in thinking that the Hudson Mark III was being introduced to the squadron?
I don't recall any Mark IIs. Mark III, yes. I don't know whether they... what happened as far as the Mark II was... I've got the history of the Hudson somewhere. from Burbank in California, where they were made, and it gives all the marks and so on. But I don't think 269 had any Mark IIs. Now, the only difference between the Mark I and the Mark III was that the engines have been boosted a little more, and we had totally feathering propellers. Previously, the propeller, if you stopped an engine, or the engine stopped, the propeller would keep rotating on the Mark I, but with a total feathering propeller, well, it was a triple wing, no, triple
prop. Triple prop?
Propeller, yes. Mm. Propeller. Yes, triple propeller. They feathered.
And as well, I was thinking of the period in May 1941 when the squadron was prepared for hunting for the Bismarck. Can you take me through that in as much detail as you can remember what happened?
Yes, that was the 21st of May, I think. The Bismarck was ultimately sunk on the 25th. And it's a little known fact, actually, that 220 Squadron was the first one to have a go at it. Well, we had, my crew, had just landed that morning after a night patrol and early dawn escort. And so we were in bed during the early afternoon when there was a lot of hustle and bustle. So obviously we went down to see what was happening. And on the flight board, the notice was Strike Hipper. H-I-P-P-E-R is the name of one of the German battle cruisers. The ship had been identified by a flight by the PIU people as having got steam up in Bergen. Now, on Bergen Harbour, Stortfjord, approaching Bergen Harbour. And the danger was, and the expectation was, and indeed it became a fact, and that the Bismarck, and that this boat, and we haven't yet identified it, was going to break out into the Atlantic and carry on the damaging attacks on shipping which the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau had previously been able to do before they returned to Brest. It would have been a very dangerous business because obviously the Bismarck was at that time and the most powerful battleship afloat, never mind the Hipper, which we thought it was. And the crew lists, of course, didn't include my crew, unfortunately, because we were off duty. And we sent, I think it was 10 aircraft on a strike, which was due to depart at 2300 hours that night. Which it did. The weather conditions were inclement. There was cloud cover for most of the journey. It wasn't possible to identify the boat, the ship, adequately, but there were various reports of heavy anti-aircraft fire. One aircraft managed to see open docks at Bergen, but through a gap in the clouds, but there was no sign of the ship, which had by this time been identified not as the Hipper but as the Bismarck. And that was because it was in fact not in Bergen, not even in the fjord at that time. It had left, we learned later, at 2200 hours, which was an hour before the 2300 hour departure of the attacking force. The aircraft all got back with various reports of minor incidents, a light flak here, the odd searchlight there, and so on. And Ludovic Kennedy describes in his book how when the Tirpitz was well on its way going up the coast of Norway prior to going round the top of Iceland, the lookouts looked down to the south and heard, they saw flashes and flares, etc., anti-aircraft fire, which of course were all signs of 220's effort to be the first to have a go at the Bismarck, but failed because the Bismarck had got away already. That seems to point very forcibly to the fact that at that time Coastal Command was stretched far more than any other command by having to send aircraft out into the Atlantic on the one hand and be ready to make attacks to at targets in continental waters and even on land. Coincidences were not unusual in wartime. And I remember two dates very well in 1941, where 220 Squadron was again engaged in multiplane operations, which were still quite unusual. But on the 29th of October, and I remember also the 19th, which will be coming up in a minute or two, the squadron carried out a well-known strike on enemy shipping. And they took off from Wick at 1600 hours and landed at 2200 after completing what was acknowledged as the most brilliant shipping attack of the war by a single squadron at that time, known as the Olsson Strike. At the entrance to Stord Fjord in Norway, Olsson was sheltered by a number of islands and backed by mountains. It obviously offered enemy shipping a relatively secure anchorage, but not that night. Seven ships were sunk. But unaware to the air crews taking part at the time, they were part of a very important coincidence which saved the crew of the Shetland Bus. And the Shetland Bus, whose skipper was Leif Larsen, was a Norwegian fisherman, and he would eventually be awarded the DSO, the DSC, the CGM, the DSM, and Barr. What a man. The Shetland thus was the name given to the constant sailing of small boats between the Shetland Islands and Norway, taking equipment and returning with agents and refugees, etc. And a fishing boat left Shetland on the 19th of October, 1941, and it made landfall on the Norwegian coast at Stadland, sailed towards Kristiansand because it was on a mine-laying mission. Following severe storms, it began to break up and was beached near Gripenhullen, and the crew of seven, headed by Captain Larsen, decided to head for Alfsund, some 70 miles to the south, the home of one of the crew, to obtain a boat to return to the UK. After 6 days of dangerous movement, evading the Germans, tramping through forests, climbing the peaks, crossing fjords, they arrived at the house of a neighbour of the Boinboy family, whose son was a crew member. They stayed there for 2 days, and then Boinboy's father told them of a boat named the Arthur, and they decided to take her that night. But early that evening, Frau Boinboy ran in, alarmed. They must hurry. The Gestapo were here. They've been asking for the children. They've been asking the children if they'd seen five men in oilskins and sea boots. They were searching a house down the road. It was a matter of minutes. At that moment, the air raid warning sounded, and immediately after came the crash of RAF bombs from the harbour, and the German defences went into action. The five men picked up their clothes and ran for a rowing boat which they'd seen on the beach. They took it and hid until they were there. And there was no one on. They were sure that there was no one on board the Arthur. And then they rowed quietly out and climbed aboard. They crawled about the decks on all fours to inspect her. The engine, oil in the tanks, food and bedclothes, new sails in the cabin. Boinboy's father came out to them with more food and charts and a log. And told them where a barrel of oil was cached. Under cover of the noise of the air raid, they started the engine and slipped quietly out into the darkness, stopped to pick up the barrel, then headed for the sound, which led to the open sea. The sound had a seaplane base on one side, would you believe, and a German watch post on the other, but 220 Squadron were keeping the Germans busy. And safely through the sound, the Arthur set course for Shetland. Their safe return for future clandestine activities was probably more important than the effects of the raid itself. Unwittingly, 220 Squadron could take the credit for a double success.